father of psychoanalysis, said some time ago, despite my 30 years of research into the feminine soul, I have not yet been able to answer the great question, what does a woman want? And that's been a mystifying to men a long time. You know, it's interesting how women, they say, I don't know what the big deal is, and we certainly understand you, and that is true. Most women can figure us out very quickly. Most men cannot figure women out very quickly at all. Often get frustrated and just kind of put distance because it's just not working out that easily. Well, there are some reasons for that. In fact, that misunderstanding has been the butt of jokes, really, in men. Women get a little hurt by that, but men make fun of what they don't understand. That's a very natural human reaction. I remember hearing the story about Winston Churchill, who had plenty of enemies, you know, not just the Nazis. He had plenty of enemies within the parliament, in the British parliament. And one of them was Lady Astor. Lady Astor was a member of parliament who was very vocal and very, politically speaking, very much against him in what he stood for. After a close vote one day when Churchill won the vote, Lady Astor, standing in the very back, raised her voice and complained. She said, Winston Churchill, you know, she cried out to him, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your tea. She said that in front of everybody. Now, she, you know, she really said it like it was. She didn't mince with words. But Churchill put his thumbs under his lapels, looked away and said, Lady Astor, he answered, you know, loud voice, if I were your husband, I would drink the tea. Proverbs. Now, I don't want you to go to your wife and say, you know, I found a couple of great jokes that made fun of women today. But the fact is that we tend to make fun of what we don't understand or whenever we're embarrassed. Men have a very difficult time, especially they're embarrassed by their wives. Boy, that is tough. And women have a difficult time understanding how it is that a man can be so easy. Brain research has shown some interesting things about both men and women. In 1960s, it wasn't until the 1960s that there was some serious brain research that took place. In fact, the originator, I can't remember his name now, won the Nobel Prize in medicine for the work that he had done in brain research. Over the last 40, 50 years, this has continued. And now we understand that there are some clear differences between men and women. And the differences stem from what happens in the brain. As you know, we have two hemispheres, right? The right hemisphere, the brain hemisphere, the right, left hemisphere. Interestingly enough, there's considerably more men that are left-handed than women. Very few women are left-handed, but quite a few more men are left-handed. What does that do? Why? Left hand is a function of the right side of the brain. We call it the right brain. It's really not well said. It's the right hemisphere of the brain. What are the differences between the two? What is the left hemisphere for? Can anybody tell me? Language, speech, analysis, logic, order, system, all of those things, details. All of those things take place in the left hemisphere of the brain. What takes place in the right hemisphere of the brain? The aspects that have to do with artistic aspects, creativity, intuitiveness, emotion, connections, leaps of logic, all of those things are right side of the brain. Somebody who is well respected for the use of his brain said once, Albert Einstein, he said, the left brain, he meant the left hemisphere, the left brain is your faithful servant. He was telling some students that. Your right brain, and there's a lot of truth about that. You know what research has shown, though? Let me ask you this. Who do you think, men or women, would have a predominant use of the right side of the brain. Men or women, predominant, just slightly, very slightly, but that's what research has shown. The right side is the emotional, the artistic, the intuitive, the concrete. Women, that is what most men say. But research shows, are you ready for this? That men score a little higher on that. That's shocking. How could that be? Aren't women the ones that are more emotional than men are? Not if you go to a football game. Huh? Not if you go to a football game. Not if you engage in politics and get serious about it. Think about it. Men are very capable of getting extremely emotional about things that women say, what's the big deal? It has to do with concreteness. It has to do with concreteness. Most men understand reality in concrete ways. That's why, in part, men are better spatially than women are. Have you driven with your wife? In most cases, there are always exceptions, you know. And you're trying to find directions. And you're driving. You say, is this the exit? Or you're asking for directions. And she has the map. Says, you know, and she's looking at it the wrong way. You know, she has to turn it around to try to see it. I don't need to turn it around. I turn it around in my head. That's why most men are in, you know, there's a much higher number of men that are engineers and that are scientists as such, or mathematicians in general. Why? Spatial thinking. Why? Because that has to do with concrete things. That's why men are very good with their hands also. And men are very good, men are very good cooks. The best men, the best cooks in the world are men. The best fashion designers in the world are men. Why? There's another reason for it. And that whole has to do with the brain. It has to do with the fact that women can do several things at a time and men can. Now, women figured this out from the time they were 12. Have you seen a woman feed a baby, answer the phone, and tell an older child something all at the same time? Can you do that? Most of us are totally dumbfounded about it. We get all rattled up about that, you know? We take care of one thing and then we take care of something else. Well, if you have to focus on one thing, you're going to get good at it. And that's why most men can be even better than women in the things that women mostly excel at. Why? Because they really focus on it. They don't focus on anything else. But you know what? Women can take care of everything else. Now, this is a tough thing for our ego. But think about it. If that were not the case, this world would be pretty lame if it was just up to us. How can we understand that as far as brain research? What happens is that women, when they're little girls, it has been proven that much earlier than boys, they develop their synapses are stronger and more numerous between both hemispheres. There's no concrete proof yet as to what the reasons are. There are some speculations, for instance, that girls talk or are invited to engage in conversation a little bit more, you know, sooner than boys. Boys play with toys and with cars, and they sort of tell things, you know, tell an order or receive it, or, you know, it's more boom, boom, boom. A woman engages in the sophistication of conversation at a much earlier age. Because of that, it forces them to develop more something in between. Observe, for instance, when you watch the news, the best interpreters, in spite of the fact that this is still a men's world, the best interpreters, language interpreters, are not men. They tend to be women. You see them next to presidents all the time. Why? For the same reason. The use of both hemispheres. Men are more linearly oriented, more focused. Okay, let's focus on this thing and get it done. Women are more horizontally. They distribute themselves a little broadly. Now, this is an interesting thing. When I teach my preaching class, I share some of this brain research and say, why do you think that the church has more women than men? Well, there's a number of reasons for it. But one reason is women can handle bad sermons better than men can. You know why? Because men get bored a lot sooner than women do because they do not fill in the gap. So for a bad preacher, a woman listens to a bad preacher and she fills in the gap. The things that he didn't say or didn't say quite right, she makes up for it. A man doesn't. And that's why, man, if you don't tell me good concrete illustrations, if you don't make it clear, I'm going to get bored with you, preacher. I'm going to be out of here. Therefore, it is very important to really preach concretely. That's one of the reasons why, think about it. You know, we say Jesus spoke in parables because everybody loves the story. Sure, everybody loves the story. But who were the listeners? Most of the listeners were men because women did not. You see those in pictures, but what do they know? You see pictures where you see all kinds of women out there and children. No, that was the rare exception. Most everyone who ever listened to Jesus was a man. They were the ones that were allowed to be outside and seen in public. Women were not allowed to go out and be seen in public, let alone listen to somebody in order to learn something from that somebody. So there must have been very few women. Jesus was talking to primarily maybe 8 or 9 out of 10 people that he talked to in those multitudes were men. Therefore, he told them concrete stories. Stories that they would remember. Why? Women are not as visually oriented as men are. Men are visually oriented, more so than women are. And when he tells the story, you can see it in your mind's eye. And as the man 2 weeks later, or 10 days later, or 3 days later, was working in his land, he would remember what Jesus said about the sower that went out to sow. And he would visualize again what Jesus had told him. Therefore, he could more concretely put into practice, oh yeah, now I understand what he's doing. Men and women are different. Men are concrete. They seek for concrete experiences. Women fill in the gaps. Women really treasure relationships. That's not something that most men really treasure naturally. What they treasure is to see a good job done, you know, a job well done. Is to see that a plan comes together. Is to see that things work the way they're supposed to work. Is to see something be productive and good. So a man is more task-oriented in that sense. A woman is more, she will sacrifice quality of those things, but never a quality of relationship. Relationships really matter to a woman. The Bible acknowledges such differences. Would you believe that? In the wisdom through the Holy Spirit. Turn in Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. By the way, I just want to acknowledge my father right here. I just saw that he had come in. And I hadn't seen him. They've been living out here in Maryland and we are from Tennessee. In Ephesians 5, listen to what God says to men and women. Verse 22, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. Now, that tends to rankle many women. And it tends to be misunderstood by many men. Continues to say, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Quite specific, quite clear. Oh, I have found all kinds of commentators trying to argue their way away from this. Say, well, this is, really doesn't mean this, and this and that, and this and that. That's pretty specific. We'll comment on that in a minute. Husbands, verse 25, love your wives. That's a totally radical difference. One says, respect your husband. The other one says, or submit to your husband. The other one says, love your wife. Two totally different verbs. Two attitudes that are different. Oh, they're both positive, very positive, but very different. Why didn't God say to the woman, love your husband, and to the husband, love your wife? Or submit to one another, as Paul had said in a previous case. Love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. So also, husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. Women to submit. Why? Possibly because one of the greatest needs men have is to be respected. A man really, really appreciates to be respected. When others consider that individual like he knows what he's doing. And men, if if I were talking to wives today, I would say to them, if you really want to stomp over your husband, discredit him in front of other people. That's about the worst thing you can do. Humiliate him one way or another. Disrespect him. That's the worst thing you can do.
Yeah. Well, it's a serious business, you know.
So women are asked by the Holy Spirit to submit to men because men need respect. In fact, they almost need respect more than they need love. Men interpret respect as genuine love. And that's why it's easier for a man to spend more time at the office. Why? Because at the office, you see greater evidences of respect. Now, it may not be genuine, or it may not be wholehearted, but other people in the office, or other co-workers, they respect him because that's a good thing. A man feels good about that. It's very important. It's extremely important. And Jesus, in his wisdom, said to the women, submit to your husbands. In fact, the interesting thing is this. This really works both ways. If a man loves a woman like Jesus loved the church, I have yet to find a woman, in a normal, good, healthy woman, who would not be happy to... There's... We will not quote you. Men are told, however, to love. Men are told to love their wives. Why? What does that do? Whereas men need respect, women need to be paid. If you pay attention to a woman, you see, this is one of the major reasons, I firmly believe, this is one of the major reasons why marriages actually take place. Some guy really paid attention to this girl. And you know what? It doesn't take long for that girl to say, hey, this is it for me. I don't need anything else. He loves me. He thinks I'm really something. He listens to me. He actually is interested in what I have to say. He's interested in what I do, in my opinions. A woman who finds a man that really pays attention to her, boy, you're mine. I mean, I'm yours, they say. You can do whatever you want with me. God knew exactly what needed to happen. One is a relational act. Women to submit is a relational act. They cannot do that voluntarily. I mean, in a sense of volition, it's a difficult thing for a woman to submit to a man. But if she thinks of this as a relational scheme, it's easier for her to do that. This is the best way for the family. This is the best way for both of us. This is the best way for our lives to work best. On the other hand, a man needs not answer this injunction by Jesus on a relational basis. God never said, fall in love with your wives in order to love your wives. He just told us a command, love your wife. In other words, that is a choice. It is a choice. And you know what? I don't know if it happens to you, but it certainly happens in my home. I've been married 20 years and to a woman. And we've learned a lot from one another in the process. If my wife let me put it this way. My wife does not understand that I love her so much so because I sent roses to her or because I speak sweet nothings to her ear. My wife understands that I really love her when I say, I'll do the dishes. Or when I say, you seem tired, why don't you just rest and I'll take... Or when I'll say, last night you mentioned something you wanted fixed. What was it, honey? That speaks huge things to her. That, to her, that means he really loves me. Why? Because he paid attention to what I... You don't know how crucial... I mean, that is. It is harder for us to see what the big deal is. But it is certainly a huge...
Let me read to you a quick story. In the supermarket, Curtis, the stock boy, was busily working when a new voice came over the speaker asking for a carryout at check register number 4. Curtis was almost finished and wanted to get home some fresh air and decided to answer the call. As he approached the checkout stand, a distinct smile caught his eye. The new checkout girl was beautiful. She was an older woman, maybe 26. He was about 22. And he fell in love. Later that day, after his shift was over, he waited for the punch clock to fill out her name. She came into the break room, smiled softly at him, and took her card and punched out, then left. He looked at her card, Brenda. He walked out only to see her start walking up the road. Now, what's the first thing that attracts him? Typical male response. We are very visual. She's a pretty girl. She said, you know, well, I like her. I think I'm in love. Why? Pretty girl. Okay. But there's more to it. Listen to this. Next day, he waited outside as she left the supermarket and offered her a ride home. So far, so good. He looked harmless enough, and she accepted. When he dropped her off, he asked if maybe he could see her again outside of work. Now, this is where it gets nervous. You know, women get nervous with this. She simply said it wasn't possible. He pressed, and she explained she had 2 children, and she couldn't afford a babysitter. So he offered to pay for the babysitter. Reluctantly, she accepted his offer for a date for the following Saturday. Now, what do women, you know, what do women think of when a nice-looking guy wants to go out with him, and they say, yeah, what this guy doesn't know is that I have 2 children from a previous marriage. As soon as she says them, what is she thinking? He is gone, you know. I'm going to just see the dust of his feet. The fact that he wasn't says volumes to her. Says, this guy's different. He's more substantive than the way I look, or the way I smell, or the way I smile. She accepted his offer for a date for the following Saturday. That Saturday night, he arrived at her door only to have her tell him that she was unable to go with him. The babysitter had called and canceled. To which Curtis simply said, well, let's take the kids with us. Now, there's a couple of women here, and they already know what they're thinking about that. I mean, this already says, whoa, wow. I mean, this guy is a real big fake. He's really after something, you know. Or he is cut out of a totally different mold. You mean you'd be willing to take these kids to a date? She tried to explain that taking the children was not an option. But again, not taking no for an answer, he pressed. Finally, Brenda brought him inside to meet her children. She had an older daughter who was just as cute as a bug, Curtis thought. Then Brenda brought out her son in a wheelchair. He was born a paraplegic with Down syndrome. Curtis asked Brenda, I still understand why the kids can't come with us. Brenda was amazed. Most men would run away from a woman with 2 kids, especially if one had disabilities, just like her former husband and father of the children. That evening, Curtis and Brenda loaded up the kids, went to dinner and the movies. When her son needed anything, Curtis would take care of him. When he needed to use the restroom, he picked him up out of his chair, took him, brought him back. The kids loved Curtis. At the end of the evening, Brenda knew this was the man she was going to marry and spend the rest of her life with. Why would she know that?
this guy cares for me, cares for the things that are important to me. He is a relationally based individual. This guy cares for my children. I have found my Superman. I don't need any. I mean, there's no better people like that than that. That's what really matters.
A year later, now you'll recognize them. They were married, and Curtis adopted both of her children. And since then, they have added two more kids. So what happened to the stock boy and checkout girl? Well, Mr. and Mrs. Kurt Warner now live in St. Louis, where he is employed as a St. Louis Rams, by the St. Louis Rams, and plays quarter, the greatest heroes for men. But look at this guy. You have the opposite. And this little story also tells us a little bit about the differences between men and women. This is an apocryphal story, obviously. After a long illness, a woman died and arrived at the gates of heaven. Okay? Apocryphal. To make a point. While she was waiting for St. Peter to greet her, she peeked through the gates and saw a beautiful banquet table. Sitting all around were her parents and all the other people she had loved who had died before. They saw her and began calling greetings to her. Hello, how are you? We've been waiting for you. Good to see you. When St. Peter came by, the woman said to him, "This is such a wonderful place." Why is it wonderful? All of these people I have relations with. How do I get in? You have to spell a word. That's a good man answer. You have to spell a word, St. Peter told her. Which word? The woman asked. Love, answered St. Peter. The woman correctly spelled L-O-V-E, and St. Peter welcomed her into heaven. Apocryphal story. About a year later, St. Peter came to the woman and asked her to watch the gates of heaven for him that day. While the woman was guarding the gates of heaven, her husband arrived. I'm surprised to see you, the woman said. How are you doing? Oh, I've been doing pretty well since you died. Her husband told her, I mean, that's not a nice thing to say. But it gets worse. I married the beautiful young nurse who took care of you while you were ill. And then I won the lottery. I sold the little house you and I lived in. I mean, that's really tough. You know, this means a lot to a woman. The little house you and I lived in and bought a big mansion. And my wife and I traveled all around the world, which is probably something he hadn't done with his previous wife. We were on vacation and I was water skiing today. I felt the ski hit my head and here I am. So how do I get in? You have to spell a word, the woman said. Which word? Her husband asked. Czechoslovakia. Proverbs talks about that there is no greater ire than a woman scorned, you know. And that's what it is. If you mess up with my relationships, if you take him lightly, you're done with me. I'm through. I'm so hurt by it. It's going to be very hard for me to recover. Well, let's look at women in the Bible. The rabbis had several sayings about women. Now listen to this. Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a heathen. Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a bondman, a slave. Blessed art thou, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has not made me a woman. So women were at the level of slaves and Gentiles. In other words, really, really far back in the strata of human beings. Another rabbi statement was, happy is he whose children are males, and woe to him whose children are females. I was pretty much the case. And I don't know, those of you who've among us here who have traveled some, you realize that in many societies, there's a lot of this kind of thinking still. If a boy is born, that's a big deal, especially if that's the first child. We still have that remnants of that in our own society. You know, we really would like to have a boy. If anything, we're going to have a boy. But in other places out there, the difference between having a boy and having a girl are just very, very wide.
like a girl. Oh, man, what's the use? If I have a boy, I can brag with my friends, etc. No women were allowed at mealtime to eat with men in Bible times. If a woman was seen to eat with men, that woman was usually a prostitute, but not a family member. No mothers, no sisters, no daughters. If there were men, women could eat with women. But if the gathering was a gathering where there were men, any men in it, women were not in that. That's why when Mary Magdalene anointed Jesus' feet, it was a scandal of the greatest proportions at many levels. Not just the fact that she spent a year's worth of salary on a perfume. Not just the fact that she let her hair down. And her hair, you know, we still have that expression, letting your hair down. Well, letting your hair down in biblical times was what a woman did only in front of her husband and usually when they were about to make love. In other words, it's not something that anybody ever saw in public. And she did this. So it was scandalous of the highest degree. Women were not to speak in public at all. In fact, a woman was never to address a man. And a man was not to address a woman in public. Women were not to be seen in public. I even saw that in modern times. I remember in Jordan, one time I was in Amman, Jordan. Amman is the capital of Jordan, one of the more advanced of the Arab nations, you know, more Western, if you will. And I remember going through that one day and hardly seeing any women at all. There were tons of people out there in the street. They were all men. 9 out of 10 of them were men. Of course, the 10% were the women, veiled faces, etc. Women were not to be seen in public. Women were to be in the household. And the households were made, usually smaller ones, that were one-room homes. But many times there were several homes together. They were family members, and they added a room to the house. That's why Jesus said, you know, in John 14, says, I'm going, but I'm going to prepare rooms for you, and I will come back and take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. That's a speech that a bride would give to his wife, basically, you know. And so they had homes, and there was a courtyard in the middle, and women's world was that, in those homes and in the courtyard. Now, they could, and it was okay, if they went outside to the market to purchase food and to do those things that had to do with survival, the survival of the household, but not much more than that. That is why it was astonishing to the disciples to see Jesus speak to not only a Samaritan, but a woman. And what they didn't realize is that Jesus addressed her first. Men never spoke to women. Why? Because it was interpreted that if a man would speak to a woman, it would be for sexual reasons. It had sensual connotations. Women were never to be educated. There was no such a thing as an educated woman. Women were not allowed in their rabbinical schools, in part because they were not considered to be as smart. How could they be as smart? They were dealing with children all the time. They were dealing with food and just basic necessities and keeping the house clean. How could they be as smart? They didn't read. No woman anybody knew read or could quote the rabbis about this or that or talk politics or even talk religion. Women were also not seen in public eating, in part because many times a woman would be unclean because of her menstrual period. And if a woman was unclean, she was not to be in public. And so many times, in order to just take care of matters easily, women just kind of kept them out. Because religiously speaking, if they were unclean, they were not supposed to be. Women were never to be touched, again, because of the sexual connotations.
And I mentioned the issue about the hair. The rabbi said regarding the education of women, it's better to teach a Samaritan in the Jewish people. Just they hated Samaritans more so than they hated Gentiles because they considered them to be half-breeds. Gentiles didn't know any better. They were outside of God's salvation. But Samaritans should have known better because they used to be Jews who intermingled because of women, foreign, they intermingled with pagans. Therefore, they were mixed. They were mixed. And so there was a high sense of prejudice against them. Regarding their marriage, for instance, let me just see if I can read something to you. Oh, here's another statement by the rabbis regarding education. If any man teaches daughter Torah, that's the first five books of Scripture, it is as though he taught her lechery. It was considered to be really, really bad. In the case of marriage, most women were married when they were very young. Many of them prepubescent. So girls could marry at 11 or 12, often. In fact, there was a law, a rabbinical law, that when a man couldn't be that young. A man had to be about 18 or 19. But there was a law that said that they could not have intimacy together until she had demonstrated that she had had three periods, because many of these girls were not still grown up. That's the way it started. So 11, 12, this is how it started. So it was submission all the way through from the very beginning. Only the husband had the right of divorce. A woman could not ask for the right of divorce. And control of a dowry, a woman's dowry passed into the hands of her husband upon marriage. The dowry was how much she was worth based on her father, what her father's, you know, considered, you know, what he negotiated with the bridegroom. Married women wore a veil. The only adult women who did not wear veils were those who were not under the authority of a man. In other words, widows or prostitutes. Although the husband had the right to divorce, he was required to return his ex-wife dowry if he did so. So he lost money if he got divorced. That was Moses' way to discourage divorce. At marriage, the two families exchange expensive gifts, which were normally listed in the marriage contract, which meant that a man's daughters and a man's wife or wives were part of his property when he got married. All of that belonged to him, and it was actually listed as part of the property. Just like a horse would be property, and chickens would be property, and land would be property. Wife, this is property of the man. These gifts were lavish as each family could afford. It was common for much of the worth of the household to be tied up in a woman's dowry. Remember the story of Jesus in Luke 15, when the woman lost one of the 10 coins, silver coins? Well, her dowry was those 10 coins, and so this was incredibly important. Since it would impoverish most husbands to have to return their wife's dowry, this is one factor that made divorce very uncommon. So it was the money issue. It was not other issues. Women took care of the household work, purchasing, preparing, cooking food, caring for children, clothing the family, engaging in other activities necessary to running the household, dominated the time and energies of the women in the house. I mentioned to you earlier, I was in Ghana. Did I mention that? Maybe I didn't. About a year and a half ago. And in that society, women work very hard at simply keeping the rest of the family alive. And everything has to do with survival. It takes several hours to prepare meals. It takes time to keep things clean. And so it takes an entire day's work just to keep things for crumbling, from going bad. And that has been the experience of women most of the history of the world. Well, when you look at the way women were looked at in the time of the Bible, I have summarized 5 points that are clear. And I want to write them down here and see what Jesus did with those. Number one, women were not worth educating. Not worth. Number two,
The woman was the property of another, of the husband, most of the time. It was the property of the father first, obviously. Women, in general, were seen as sex object. That is the reason. I mean, for good and bad, for pleasure and for procreation. And that was why God had made women. That was the idea. Number four, women had nothing to contribute to a man's world. That is related to number one, obviously. Nothing to contribute to a man's world. And for that is that women were considered to be obviously not as smart. So what could they give the world? A boy of 12 was considered much more worthwhile than a woman at 50 or 16 with all her experience. And finally, I'll keep it at that. How did Jesus treat women then with these four great challenges? The fifth one. Women were not loved for who they were. Not loved for who they were. Women that were loved physically were prostitutes. And by the way, prostitution was not legal in Israel, but it was practiced. It was so common that is why you see prostitutes that were up in the open. You remember the case of Judah, remember? With his daughter-in-law? Out in the open. Nobody hid from that. It was the equivalent of today's, if you were to say it, in some countries I think you have it in Scandinavia, legalized prostitution. That's what it was, the equivalent of that. How did Jesus deal with that? Well, let's take number two, for instance, property of the husband. What did Jesus do with that? Jesus cared for them as individuals. That is what he decided to do with women as he dealt with them. He cared as individuals, not as part of a household. He cared for them as individuals. And you have examples. For instance, the widow of Nain. He restored her son. Remember the story, right? Why did he restore her son to life? Oh, there's a lot of talk about, well, she depended on her son because every woman depended on another man for a name and for survival. You know, either her father or her husband or her brother, if he was older, or her son eventually when she got older and her husband died. But that is not the only reason. The major reason is most women who could not depend on a man had to become prostitutes in order to survive. So Jesus saves her from that. He thinks of her as an individual and cares for her as an individual. He's thinking about the impact it has. Remember the story of a woman who was bent over for 18 years? She was hunched over with this disease. What does he call her? This daughter of God. He gives her worth. He thinks of her. Nobody would have given two bits of attention to her. In fact, one example is in Matthew 15. Remember the story in Matthew 15? It's repeated in Mark 7 or so? The Canaanite woman who chased after the disciples and Jesus and said, Master, my daughter is demon-possessed. Please heal her. Remember what Jesus' first reaction was? What was it? No, not put her down yet. What was his first reaction? Ignored her, totally ignored her, didn't respond to her. That's exactly what people would do. So Jesus did exactly what everybody else would do to see what the disciples would do with that, because they should have known better by now, you see. Well, in this case of this woman, we'll pick up that story later, but in the case of the bent over woman, 18 years, in the throes of Satan, he said, he considers her to be so important, he is going to free her because she is special to God. Now that's a concept nobody had ever heard of before. That a woman would be special to God, but she's a woman. A woman would be special.
In the case of his mother, obviously, he took care of her while he was dying on the cross. Now think about that. None of us has ever experienced and will never probably experience what it would be like to die on the cross. But Jesus, who was holy and undefiled, he was one with the Father. Think about this. What happens to you and me when we separate ourselves from God because of our sins, because of our choices? Well, we may suffer a little bit. Sometimes we may miss it a little bit. But by and large, because of our fleshly nature, we sort of live with it, right? In fact, it is a shame to us, but it is true that many times our relationship with Jesus is not very close, and we don't miss it, do we? We miss other things more. We miss certain games more. We miss certain activities more. We miss certain work more than we miss Jesus. But think about Jesus. In the case of Jesus, he was holy and undefiled. All he knew was what it was like to have a beautiful, full-fledged relationship with his Father. He had said in John 5, I don't say anything of my own accord. As I hear, I judge. In Isaiah 50, verse 4, it says, the Father wakes me up morning by morning and gives me the ear of a disciple to listen as a disciple. Jesus said, I have laid my life down to be taken up again. In other words, he chose for God to do everything through him. Why? Because he was so much one with his Father. Can you visualize, I don't know what better example to use. Can you imagine what it would be like if after 40 years of life, you recognized that there was two of you and not one. And somehow, the two had to be separated. There are stories about people who lose limbs, who feel the limb for years later, as if they still had that limb, because it's in the nervous system. It has been so much a part of you. In the case of Jesus, he is being separated from his Father. He is being extricated. He is being pulled apart from his Father. The Tsar of Ages says that the Father was closest to Jesus at that moment than ever before. But Jesus was unable to perceive it. In fact, he went to the cross as he was hanging there. You can read that in Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is a clear description of what Jesus experienced. And there's a tremendous agony. And Jesus, this is what killed him. What killed him was not so much all the wounds. That was nothing. Many other people had put up with wounds. That was not his concern. The weight of sin had separated him from his Father. And that was so agonizing to him. It is hard for us to perceive it because we are already separated. We don't know what it's like to have been united so much. That separation killed him. That killed him. But think about that. At the moment in which everything about him cries out to be one with the Father, he takes a look at his mother and he thinks of her. Now, how many of us would do that? How many of us would do that? That we're so consumed with pain. How many of us dying in a hospital bed, for instance, or after an accident, or greatly under stress, when we are totally consumed by pain and suffering, we think of somebody else. But Jesus thought of his mother and told John, please take care of her. Now it's hard for us to fathom what that is like. How could that possibly be? Really, it's incredible that Jesus would even think about that. But he would take care of his mother. In John 4, you have the story of Jesus with a woman at the well. And he called her to task, right? He says, call your husband. Now, here's a little parenthesis. This is for free. How did Jesus know that she had five husbands and the one that she then now had was not her husband? Well, there's two or three explanations to that. One is, well, Jesus is God. Therefore, he knows everything. But that is denied by other statements in other words. Jesus is God, but he didn't function in this world
with the attributes that God has, which is one of them is omniscience, you know, knowing everything. He functioned like you and me. He says, well, what about his miracles? Well, what about Elijah and Elisha and Peter and Paul? They all did miracles, and they were human beings. In other words, they relied completely and absolutely in the power of God. Another explanation could be, so that first explanation is not a good one. The second one could be, well, he had a clear impression by the Holy Spirit that this was so. That led her to. And that could certainly be the case. I'd like to offer to you a third possibility. And we don't have time to explore it. But in 1 Kings chapter 17, you have the summary of the misery of Israel. The years and years of apostasy from God. And in that chapter 17, the scribe that writes it, whether it's Samuel or Ezra or who, you know, we don't know exactly who, bemoans how much God had done so much for Israel, for these 10 northern tribes, and Israel kept apostatizing and playing, quote-unquote, the harlot with God. Finally, God turned them over to the Assyrians. And in verse 24, it says something interesting. It says, they killed all these Israelite men, and they took prisoner some of the other ones. But the women were left in Israel. But in order to keep the race going, you know what the Assyrians did? They brought men from 5 different nations. And it mentions each one of those nations, one of them being Babylon, to intermarry with these Jewish women. Now, when Jesus looked at this woman of Samaria, this is the first time anyone thinks about taking the gospel outside of God's people. Jesus took that initiative. And he did this with a Samaritan woman. So he is looking at her based on what he knows from Samaria. This woman to him represents the nation of Samaria. So he says, yeah, you've had 5 husbands, haven't you? And the one that you now have is not your husband. Sure enough, at the time of Jesus, Samaritans did not worship God alone. They worshiped God in a mixture with other gods. It was a pagan Jehovah mixture. Anyway, that's for your pure minds to think about. So that's a possibility. But Jesus says, call your husband, which was a natural thing to do. And yet he continued to teach her. He continued to think of her as worthwhile. Think of her as an individual. Most men would have said, call your husband before I even talk to you. Because you have no worth. I cannot speak to you unless I speak to your husband. It's like the equivalent today of having of seeing a 3-year-old and needing to make a decision. Let's talk to your dad about this and make the decision, as opposed to have the 3-year-old make the decision. So that's the property of the husband. Jesus cared for women as individuals. Regarding not being worth educating, where did I put this? What did Jesus do? Jesus considered them very valuable. He considered them, even though they couldn't demonstrate that because they had no education, but he considered them as valuable. He took them as if they were very worthwhile contributing, worthwhile individuals. For instance, remember in Luke 10, what's in Luke 10? I'm making a big assumption, and that is that you know your Bible. In Luke 10, what do we have? We have the story of Mary and Martha, right? Do you know what the Greek says? You remember that Martha was upset. Says, how come you don't, you know, Martha was doing what women are supposed to do, which is to take care of guests, to take care of the food, to take care of lining up all these things. And she was probably nervous because Jesus was there, and whenever Jesus hung around, there were a few dozen of his friends. So this is a big meal, right? This is not just Jesus himself, okay? This is a whole bunch of people, a couple of dozen people there. And this is close to the time of the cross, about 3 or 4 weeks. No, this is about 4 months before that. Anyway, after Mary Magdalene had really returned, and after Jesus had done his final work with her, that's another story. And Mary, what does she do? She does the unthinkable.
Jesus is sitting. This is the way it used to be out there. A teacher always sat down. And the students sat down before him, the disciples. And the teacher dispensed wisdom. And they were all men, nothing but men. The women worked out there in the kitchen. They prepared the food while the men got instructed. That is likely the setting in Luke 10. But all of a sudden, this gal comes out there, you know, the younger sister, and she sits down with everybody else. Unthinkable. In fact, the Bible gives us the understanding in the Greek that she sat right next to him. As if nobody could notice that, you know. Right next to him. And so Martha is just going crazy out there, and she just can't handle it anymore. And she just lets Jesus have it. Says, don't tell my sister to do the right thing. And what does Jesus do? He does the unthinkable. He says, you know what it says in the Greek? He says, she has chosen the best dish. Ooh. A play on words. Help her. You know, have her help me with the food. She has chosen the best. She has chosen what really matters most. And I'm going to let her. She needs to learn. And I'm going to teach her. I consider her worthwhile. What Jesus did was, it was breaking every norm possible. In the case of Luke 8, what do you have in Luke 8? Luke is interesting because Luke really points out some of these issues with the women in Jesus that other Gospels don't. What do you have in the first two verses in Luke 8? It says there that there were several, and it names the women by name, several of these women in Galilee who did what? Followed Jesus. In other words, the inner group, that means the 12 and a few others, Cleopas, for instance, in Luke 24, was the father of one of those 12 disciples. And so there were a few extended people besides the 12. That included women. Now, that was never heard of before. So Jesus is allowing women to come with them. He's instructing them. They're getting the same benefits that the men are getting. The same benefits. And some of those women, one of them, Susanna, and you know, was a high-class lady from Galilee. You know, her husband worked for the king. In John 4, you find the story of the woman at the well. He engages with the woman at the well, fully expecting her to see that he was the Messiah. In other words, the conversation. I have an entire sermon just on this, 45 minutes, just on this. And I won't go through it. But I want you to, if you have your Bibles, let's look at a couple verses. How Jesus handles this. When Jesus says to her, you know, you have five husbands, etc., etc. And she responds in shock. And she says in verse 19, John 4, verse 19. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. In other words, wow, how did you know this, you know? I perceive that you're a prophet. She must have been quite shocked. Now, what was the problem with this woman? The problem was that she had obviously relationship problems with men. And that was clear to Jesus from the very beginning. Why? Because the woman went to fetch water at noon. No woman ever went to the water well at noon. They went either in the morning, in the cool of the day, or in the evening. In fact, the water fountain of the city, of the town, was the gathering area for social life. That's when women finally got together and they caught up with each other on what was going on. You know, we still use that terminology, watering hole, you know, it's just that. In offices, people talk at the water, what is it, at the water fountain and so forth. Women are very social, and this is how it happened. And so the fact that this woman went at noon in the heat of the day to get water that would not be the coolest, and with no other women present, immediately told Jesus, this woman is avoiding other women. And what is the major reason why other women would avoid another woman? If that woman was messing around with her husband or whatever. I mean, women don't like that. Who would? So Jesus picked up on that fast. He understood that. He understood that she had problems with relationships, with a man.
In fact, later in verse 28, it says, once she received Jesus, the Bible specifically says, she went to talk with the men in town. Those are the only people she knew. Not with the women. Because they all went, you know, every time. And that's when you see that, here's another point. When you see that, it says, in verse 15, sir, give me this water so I will not be thirsty. And in Greek it says, nor come all the way here to draw. In other words, this is a long ways. And every time I come out here, I can almost hear them from out there. Oh, there she goes. Blah, 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 you know. It was a painful experience for her to go to the water well every day. She had no choice. She had to get water. But it was a painful experience. So Jesus is getting a little too close for comfort when he says, call your husband and this and that. Let's talk about this more. You know what the woman does? This is a typical woman who is very intelligent. You know what she does? I perceive you're a prophet. And then what does she do? What does she do next? What do you read in verse 20? Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. And you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Is that a question? No, it's not a question. What is that? That's a statement, which is the best way to ask a question. You know, you've heard good journalists, they never ask a question. They make a statement that causes a reaction. That's exactly what she did. And what does she do? She says, this subject is so touchy, I'm going to do what I've done with men in the past. I'm going to let them talk about politics and religion. They eat it up. Vroom! So she threw that thing out there. Go fetch it. That's exactly what she did. And when you read it in Desire of Ages, this is very good. I mean, women are very good at this. They're very good at it. I mean, they are usually 10 steps ahead of us on this. And so she says, blow out there. When you read this in Desire of Ages, Ellen White makes a very insightful comment that Jesus allowed her to deviate the conversation. In other words, he was on to her. He was on to her. But he treated her so, he understood her so well and treated her as she was so worthwhile that she didn't say to her, hey, wait a minute, sister. You're getting off the subject. He didn't do that. He simply went along with her. And then steer her right back. Respected her. He respected her. Even he respected her pain. She understood her to be very intelligent. He understood her to have read. And to have heard and understood messianic prophecies. He spoke to her as if she actually understood these things. And you know what? She had understood these things. She knew that. So Jesus was maintaining a very high-level religious conversation with this woman. We as men have little idea of what this could have meant, what this could mean to a woman today, let alone a woman in those days. This meant everything to her. It's like nobody had ever treated her, ever, like this. And she had dealt with men before. But the dealings men had with women at that time, again, I repeat, were issues of, you know, a woman was an object to have children, property, etc. Well, a third point, how did Jesus deal with this issue about seeing they were seen as sex objects? Jesus clearly defended them. Jesus defended them. Now, this is a great risk. Now, think about it, fellas. Think about it. If somebody has a terrible reputation, and it is very well proven, and you're the only guy that is going to come across, for instance, let's say that your wife also believes that, but you are the only one that is going to defend this woman. Are you not really inviting trouble? Most of us would do what? Keep our mouth shut. Lay low. Even if we believe that somebody is innocent, for instance, or even if we believe that somebody needs to have a better, break. Not Jesus. Not Jesus. When the woman was caught in adultery, you know, John chapter 11, she was caught in adultery, which I am convinced that woman was actually Mary Magdalene. Let me give you why I believe that. Based on some things that Ellen White says in Desire of Ages. And based on the fact that She says that Jesus knew this woman very well. He knew what she had gone through. He knew her weaknesses. And he had often, I know in that same, in 458 or another place, she gives the impression he had encountered her before. Ellen White says that he cast 7 demons out of her, at 7 different times. Jesus cried. She had heard him cry out to God on her behalf. Now, this is 7 different times, so this is a serious case of demon possession, right? I mean, this is Jesus casting out the demons, and the demons coming back 6 more times. There's a very close relationship between, by the way, between sexual aberration and demon possession. They speak to one another. They're brother and sisters, as it were. Well, in the case of Jesus, he defended this woman in front of everyone in the temple court. That is as risky as anything. And he did it in such a way, he actually called for the law. The law called for an innocent witness to throw the first stone. That's what the law called. And so Jesus spoke to those people who accused her in their language, but didn't embarrass them. I mean, he could have stood up and said, "Hey, brother, are you innocent?" You know, or he could have done all of that. No, he wrote on the ground enough so that they each could pick up their sins, not knowing who this belongs to. And so when I see mine identified, I say, "Well, okay," and out. And that's why Jesus, in a very masterful way, he says, "So where are your accusers? Where are your accusers? Neither do I condemn you. If there is somebody who could have, but I'm not going to choose to think about this." So Jesus defended them. He didn't see them as sex objects. In the case of the woman at the well, for instance, "Give me a drink." You know, John 4, verse 7. "Give me a drink," the first line, that was actually a line. It sounds, you know, when you think about it, it sounds eerily close to what people do in bars today. You know, "Can I buy you a drink?" Now, a couple of theologians I read made an interesting point about it. It says, yeah, that's probably why she paid attention to it. In fact, because this was so familiar to her. But what was the difference? Oh, and there is research that shows, biblical research that shows that the watering well, was the place where young men usually waited around in the cool of the evening for the women to come and fetch water. And they engage in conversation. That was their first date, if you will. That was the place to get each other's attention. Now, the difference was in the way Jesus said it. He placed himself under submission to a woman. And that had never been done before. Now, we don't have the tone of voice in John 4, but we can only imagine that. One thing is to say, "Give me a drink, woman." And something else is saying, "It's up to you. You can refuse it, and I'll be fine, you know. But I'm depending on you." No man ever depended on a woman. But Jesus placed himself under dependence of a woman, and that broke her. That broke that barrier immediately. Again, at Simon's house, Mary Magdalene, he defended her. Remember when Simon said, "Oh, if this guy knew, I wonder if he's really a prophet." You know, he had been healed from leprosy, right, by Jesus Christ. This is the guy that led Mary Magdalene into sin. This is Mary Magdalene's uncle, who probably fondled her when she was little. And from then on, it went on. And since she was so discredited in Bethesda, in Bethany, that she took off. And where does she end up? Sure enough, in a port city, Magdala. That's a port city. That's why she became known as Mary of Magdalene, as opposed to Mary of Bethany. And so when she comes, and when she is anointing his feet in Simon's house, Simon says, "If he only knew,
the kind of woman she is that is touching him. Remember one of the rules? No touching in public. That is a sexual act of any, you know, that if he knew. Jesus read his mind and he says, Simon, there's a story I want to tell you. And again, he told him the parable where he told him off, but only Simon could have picked it up in his great gentleness. So he took her side. Nobody in that room would ever take her side, would have taken her side. Remember Judas says, oh, in a 300 denarii, oh man, we could have done all kinds of things, good works with this. Huh? Fake, big fake that he was. So he defended her. He risked misunderstanding in order to stand by somebody who had no defense. Now, this is a remarkable thing that Jesus did. And in Matthew 15, I mentioned Matthew 15 before about the Canaanite woman. Remember? The Canaanite woman. He practiced the custom first of saying nothing, being mute, and then treating her kind of harsh, not looking at us, you know, right? This is for the Israelites, but not for the Canaanites, you know. And but he knew that she had what it took to persist, and he wanted to teach the disciples something. Finally, he lifted her above the disciples, and that really was a blow to their ego. When he said to her, woman, let it be done, how? According to you. And the Bible says, her daughter was healed instantly. Let it be done according to your faith. In other words, you disciples, you still have to grow up to be as good as to have as much faith as this woman, who is a pagan, who has only heard of me, and this is the first and only time she has seen me, and this is all it took for her to believe, to not let me go. Finally, or fourth, nothing to contribute. Women had nothing to contribute. But Jesus actually thought them very, very smart. I made a point about that already. Thought them very smart. It is interesting that we can learn, there are three major women from which we can learn that, you know, that Jesus engaged with, that we have several stories about. One is obviously his mother. The other one is Mary Bethany or Mary Magdalene. And then the other one, slipped my mind now. Who would be the third one? Oh, yeah, the woman at the well in John 4. Women were considered to be people who couldn't contribute to a man's world. And yet in John 2, he acquiesces to his mother. When his mother says, you know, this is your best chance to show that you really are the Messiah. She had been grieving. Her husband had died not long before. Jesus had stayed with her until that time. Her husband had died only 2 or 3 months before, evidently, based on something you're reading, page 145 of Desire of Ages. Jesus says to her, my time has not come. But what does he do anyway? He still does what his mother, but he doesn't do it. He adjusts it. He didn't need to do it, but he does it mostly because we'll do this. This will make it work for the good. And he accepted women disciples. We talked about it. He, in Luke 18, he mentions a story about this woman who insisted, who was onto this judge, remember? And says, give me my rights. And finally, she is given her rights, and he praises this woman for the power to change a judge's mind. That was the power that this woman had. Finally, women were not loved for who they were. They were only loved as objects, or they were loved in order to find pleasure. But Jesus loved these women for who they were. In the case of Mary Magdalene, 7 different times he cast demons out of her, agonizing cries for this prostitute, if you can believe that, for this wretched woman who nobody, not even his family, would pay attention to her, obviously, because in a shame-honor society, if a member of a family would bring shame to the family,
that member needed to be excluded totally of the family, or you're no longer a member of this family, or they were to be killed. And that's why the story of the prodigal son is a remarkable story, because the father did not kill him, neither did he disown him, showing us really the true love of the father. In the case of Mary Magdalene, Jesus loved her for who she was. She kept his own father waiting on Sunday morning. Think about this. Have you considered that? Jesus resurrected, and he needed to have gone to meet with his father. He waited until Mary Magdalene showed up. And then it wasn't after that that Jesus went up to heaven. Consider that fact. That's an incredible thing. That God would wait for this woman so that he could say to her, Mary, everything's okay. I'm alive. And everything's going to be okay. In the case of the woman at the well, he was more interested in the woman's salvation. Jesus was thirsty. It was, you know, he needed to satisfy his own basic needs. He was thirsty. He was hot. He was tired. He didn't do that. He was more interested in the salvation of the woman than in his own thirst. In the case of his mother, he submitted at 12. Says, shouldn't I be in my father's business? And yet, the next verse says, he was under their submission. He was submitted to him. For the next, he chose to do that. In the case of his mother, he took care of her at 33. So Jesus loved women, loved them. They were. Now think about this. Daughters, wives, co-workers, sisters. If we were to consider every one of them as valuable, really valuable. If we were to care for them as individuals, as the individuals they are. If we were to defend them. If we were to take their side, not criticize them. If we were to be a defender of the weak when they are in a weak situation. If we were to think of them as very smart, very capable, if we were to love them for who they were, what would it do? What would it do to our churches? What would it do to our families? What would it do to our social relations? It would simply revolutionary. You know, if a woman is treated this way, it would have to be a woman that is so hard, so callous, so far gone to not respond to this. A woman is treated halfway this good, and she'll be your slave. I'm making it in very concrete terms. In other words, she is happy to be in the company of people who would treat them this way.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.